Welcome to the National Writer Series, featuring great conversations with America's best writers. Authors interviewing one another about their inspiration, their challenges, and their craft. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the National Writer Series. Coming up this hour, Paula McLean speaks with Jodi Picoult, the author of 18 best-selling novels. Her latest, Lone Wolf, a tale of family and responsibility, debuted at number one on the New York Times bestseller list. Paula McLean first visited the National Writer Series in 2011 after the publication of her breakout novel, The Paris Wife, about the beautiful but failed marriage of Ernest Hemingway and Hadley Richardson. The two women speak about the resiliency of writers, the root of their creativity, and why Jodi Picoult can't bear to watch the movie version of her 2004 novel, My Sister's Keeper. They shared the stage at the Traverse City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan, and as Paula McLean explained, they shared other things as well.
We're near the same age. We both have three kids. We're both on next Sunday's New York Times bestseller list. Never a bad thing. And that's sort of where the similarity ends. For instance, although Jodi and I are the same age, I didn't even take a creative writing class until I was about the age that she was breaking out with her first novel. And Jodi also feels pretty comfortable saying that she had a ridiculously happy childhood, which is very rare for a writer. Mm-hmm. But for me, to meet a writer who has had a ridiculously happy childhood is sort of akin to sort of looking at a space alien.
Right. No, you're right.
Or a really exotic zoo creature.
It's actually, it's a problem, I think, if you're a writer, because you're supposed to be looking for something awful to write about. Everyone says, write what you know. And it was very clear to me when I got to college that I didn't know anything. You know, I had grown up in suburbia. I had parents who were still happily married. I had a little brother, and I like him. And, you know, I called my mother up, actually, and I said, are you sure there isn't some incest in our family that I don't know about? But there wasn't. And so, you know, that sort of became the path for me about how to write, because since I couldn't write what I knew, I had to write what I was willing to learn.
That is so interesting. I mean, it's almost a cliche, really, the way that we believe that to be a writer, you have to be completely miserable, you have to be chewing on your own, kind of your own business and your own wounds. But I remember reading this really interesting essay by Adrienne Rich, the poet Adrienne Rich, who talks about like how to make a writer. Like, what are these characteristics? When you look at writers, what are the things they have in common? Well, one, she said, is a natural facility with language and a love of language, which you clearly have, even if you weren't wounded enough as a child. You have that check. But then she also talks about this, and it's not even misery, for instance, or abuse or unhappiness, but something in childhood gives you a distance from the others and makes you feel separate enough so you can start to see human nature and become really curious about human nature.
That's really
whether
cool.
That's an illness or whether you feel just sort of like an odd duck or slightly apart. Something to give you enough of an outsider's perspective that you can see the business, and clearly you're interested in human nature. So where does that come from, even if you didn't have, quote unquote, the requisite miserable childhood?
This is going to sound so unbelievably conceited, but I was so smart. Really, and isn't that horrible? But that really,
we're gonna let her get away with
it. Yeah, you know, the
because
truth
she's
is,
so charming.
I was like, no, I was in a public high school that was enormous, you know. And to sort of put that into context for you, there were like 4,000 kids in my high school. You know, I never met even half of them. And you know, my kids go to a school now that has 500 people in it total. So we live a very different life. And when I was in high school, I never really studied, but I got straight A's, I did really, really well. I was just one of these brainiac kids. And I really think that was it. You know, there was a very small group of us sort of who were at the top taking the really hard classes and who went off from this giant public high school to Ivy League schools. And, you know, so I guess it was a little bit of that, you know, because I wasn't popular by any means, you know, and I wasn't a cheerleader. I wasn't a girl who, you know, had guys following her back and forth. I was just a really smart kid. And I guess that's the sort of thing that separated me.
The strangeness. Right?
Yeah.
So you wrote your first story mm-hmm. when you were 5 years old, right? Mm-hmm. So somewhere along the line, you began to have a sense of yourself as a writer. So mm-hmm. how did that happen? Were there important encouragements along the way?
There definitely were, and I always wrote. I honestly can't remember a time that I didn't write as a kid. My mother encouraged me, and interestingly, it was only a few years ago she let loose that she always wanted to be a writer. I never knew that about her. She was always, she's an amazing teacher, and you know, I was expecting to be a teacher, so it's very interesting that she even confessed that to me. But I used to write constantly. I used to make up these stories and illustrate them, like this one, which was called The Lobster That Was Misunderstood. And my mom still has it, unless she sold it on eBay by now. And then I got to high school, and I told you, I had this really, really happy childhood, but I had this boyfriend who was in a miserable home situation, and I was really his emotional outlet. So I wrote the darkest, most depressing poetry ever. And my mother recently brought me my poetry journal, and I'm like, wow, were you worried about me? You know, did you take me for therapy? And honestly, reading it, I'm like, gosh, you know, I would have been really worried as a parent, but I don't remember feeling that, you know, that dark, but I obviously got it out in my writing. And I had some great English teachers who knew that I liked to write and really encouraged me to do it, including the one I was telling you about who I had a crush on. And he was the one who encouraged me to apply to Princeton, because in the 1980s there were a lot of graduate creative writing programs, but not too many undergraduate ones, and Princeton had a great one. And I was lucky enough to get accepted there, and then lucky enough to be accepted into the program. And I always say that I would not be here today if it wasn't for Mary Morris, who was really my mentor at Princeton.
Right. So you're known as often sort of crediting her and saying that she taught you how to write. So when you say mm-hmm. she taught you how to write, what do you mean by that?
So this was my first workshop class. I walk in there thinking I'm the bomb. I've never gotten anything less than an A on a paper, right? And she tells me to sit on the floor with everyone else's chairs surrounding me, and she gives me a glue stick and construction paper and scissors. And she says, okay, you're not allowed to say anything. You have to do what the class says. And I'm like, okay. So she goes, where does Jody's story really start? And someone went, page 3. And she goes, that's right. Throws him over her shoulder. And she then proceeded to have the class cut and paste my story as I literally did it on these pieces of construction paper. And after an hour and a half, I walked out of there, I was in tears.
Sobbing.
And it took me 24 hours to get the courage to go to her office hours. And I said, why did you do that to me? And she said, because you needed it and because you can take it. And I was so mad at her that I went home and I edited that story and I edited it and I just kept doing that. And finally she said, well, do something with it. And of course I thought I was writing it for a class. And she said, go send it to 17 Magazine. And I did, and that wound up being my first published piece.
Nice.
Yeah.
I don't have to tell you, it doesn't always happen that way. But it also doesn't always happen that when a young writer gets discouraged,
They fight back.
They fight back. Mm.
You have to
because
have a certain
course,
kind of personality.
Yeah. We all want to be told that we're perfect mm-hmm. and brilliant and essentially the Messiah. I mean,
Yes. Right?
That's what we want to be told in writing workshop.
Right. It's like you almost needed to be crushed before you could build yourself back up again.
I think so. But whatever that is, that scrappiness or that sense of resilience or that sense of pushback, mm-hmm. you know, you're going to tell me I can't write. I'm going to show you mm-hmm. that I can. Ultimately, I think, is what it takes to be
a
writer.
It's also really important for the publishing industry because there is a lot of rejection in publishing. And honestly, I think publishing rewards the people who don't give up, who are left standing after 40 years of rejection. And, you know, that's a really, it's good to have that stubbornness in some way. Yeah,
I think so, too. But when you got the call, like, so you're in your dorm room and 17 magazine calls, right?
No, it was a message on my answering machine. And because back then we didn't have cell phones, you know. We were still writing on chisels with slate and stuff like that. there's this message on my answering machine, and it's this editor from 17, and she's left her phone number. And first I called all my friends to see who was, you know, playing a joke on me. And when it wasn't any of them, I called this woman back, and she said, we'd like to pay you to publish your story. And I said, really? Because I would pay you to publish my story. You know, it was great. And then I called my mother, and I said, Mom, I'm going to be a writer. And she said, that is so great. Who is going to support you?
You did know how rare it was, though, and what it meant. I mean,
yeah, I knew it was amazing to be published, you know, at that age. That was an incredible thing. And really, I didn't get very much money, but I was so excited. Right. And then they went and bought a second short story for me. They asked if I had anything else, and that was published a few months later. And they were both published right around the year that I graduated, because it happened when I was a junior. So it was thrilling. It was really exciting. But what I didn't realize was that didn't necessarily parlay itself into me being a writer all of a sudden, because I didn't do that. I didn't have an agent when I graduated from college, and I didn't go into writing immediately. I had this series of jobs, you know, where I was really just trying to make a living. Exactly. Because who do you know who makes a living as a writer?
Right. So what felt like a benediction and that big wet kiss on the forehead from the universe, like it's all going to be gravy from here, like follow the yellow brick road, it didn't happen that way for you.
No.
And I think not everyone who loves your work knows that, mm-hmm. because you are this publishing phenomenon.
So you know. I have a great story about this, actually. People are usually shocked to know that I had 100 rejections, more than 100 rejections from agents. And that's the first step in publishing. And so I had gotten all these rejections, and finally I connected with a woman who had never represented anyone in her life. She was starting an agency. And she goes, I think I can make this work. And I was like, okay, great. And she took my book, and she sold it in 3 months. And I am still with her 20 years later. But wait a second, this is the good part. So after my Sister's Keeper came out, and all of a sudden people kind of knew who I was, and you know, I was on the bestseller lists, and people were recognizing my name, I get this phone call from my publicist saying, a certain woman who works for a very large New York literary agency has called and would like to fly you to New York to talk about representation. And I said, you know, please extend my apologies. I am not going to come because I have no intention of leaving my agent right now. I'm very happy with her. I am also quite sure that that woman does not remember being the first person to reject me.
But you do.
Right. Great story, right?
But that novel, Songs of the Humpback Whale, that mm-hmm. was your first published novel, was not the first novel that you wrote.
No, my first novel is in a vault somewhere at Princeton, and you should all be really grateful that it's there and not on the bookshelves. But that novel really taught me how to write a novel, because that was part of my creative thesis. It was Mary holding my hand and teaching me how to juggle elephants instead of oranges, because until then I'd written short stories. And there is a colossal difference between writing a novel and writing short stories. You know, there are some similarities, but it's a very different feeling.
Right.
And I needed that. I needed my training wheels on for that first one. And then I could take the training wheels off and do something on my own.
Right. Did your current agent, though, try to sell that book, that novel?
She did, but the whole time I was writing, right? Because that's what writers do.
Yeah.
You know, we keep writing. And so by the time she signed me,
Some of us are cowering in the closet, but others aren't.
But by the time she signed me, I was finishing up this book, and I said, why don't you just take this instead?
Mm.
So I got the agent on the strength of my creative thesis, but she sold the novel that I had been writing while trying to find an agent.
Right. So you didn't have that same experience when you were, like, sort of sobbing on the floor of your creative writing workshop, like, that didn't work, so I'm going to roll up my sleeves and I'm going to go forth and into the fray and I'm going to try again. So it wasn't like that. Like, the first novel didn't sell, and so you rolled up your sleeve and you're a scrapper. You were already writing.
Yeah.
You were already in the groove.
Yeah.
I think that's rare. I mean, I think that's rare for writers to write at the speed that you write. I think it took me 5 years to write a draft of my first novel, and I had little kids, you know, who like wanted my soul out of my eyeballs, which they do, God bless them. And you want to give them your soul out of your eyeballs. But I'm sort of flabbergasted. So you were writing Songs of the Humpback Whale when you were pregnant with your first child.
Right.
Talk about what that time felt like, and how much faith did you have that the training wheels were now off, and you could write a book and launch it, and it would live in the world?
I didn't think so at all. You know, it was a total crapshoot. I had no idea what I was doing.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, because that was a very different kind of book. It was huge. The manuscript was 1,000 pages. It is to me, a very literary novel with a lot of changes in time, and the directions of the narrators go different ways. There are multiple narrators. It was a really hard novel to craft.
Right.
And I think I could do it because I hadn't had children yet and I had more brain cells. Really, you know? Everything changed after that. You know, and the second novel that I wrote was Harvesting the Heart, and the interesting thing about Harvesting the Heart was that it came from my great fantasies of how to escape this life of motherhood, because I had this child who was colicky. Kyle is 20 now, and he was colicky until last Tuesday, and so I couldn't escape him. I mean, seriously, he was always nursing, and he was always screaming, and it was so hard. I didn't realize how hard it was going to be, and I was young. I was only 25, and I used to take these walks with this friend of mine, and we lived in a suburb of Worcester, Massachusetts, and I said to her, one day, I confessed my deepest, darkest secret. We're pushing our strollers with the two babies, and I said, sometimes I think that I'm going to leave Kyle with my husband and go to the grocery store, but instead, I'm just going to keep going, and I'm going to go to Mexico, and I'm going to live in a hut on the beach, you know. And she turned to me, she stopped, and she went, oh my God, I think of that all the time. And so when I wrote Harvesting the Heart, that's really what it was. It was therapy, you know, because it's about this mother trying to deal with motherhood. And there's this scene in Harvesting the Heart where this mom, this woman of, you know, who's got a newborn, she can't handle it anymore, and she leaves the baby with her husband, and she has her husband's shirts that she's taking to be laundered, and she is throwing them one by one out the window as she drives down the highway. And for like 3 years, my husband would not let me take his shirts to the cleaners.
I wondered if he sort of felt that same way too, that you were living sort of vicariously through your characters.
Yeah.
So that was the book. That was the book you finished. Your agent sold it in 3 months. And it seems like you're sort of launched on this road, finally. So I read somewhere that Stephen King, when who speaks very highly of your work.
Which is a miracle.
Great, amazing,
I didn't know Stephen King knew I lived on the planet, seriously. So that's a great thing.
And now you know. When he sold his first book as a treat or as a present, as a blowout, he went and bought his wife a curling iron.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I heard that when you got your advance for Songs of the Humpback Whale, you went and bought your husband a piano with the $3,400 for how many hours of work and bleeding out your eyes and right?
Yeah.
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 But it didn't feel like you won
it was
the lottery.
Amazing. Yeah.
Right?
I was like, oh my gosh, this is it. This is my career. I'm ready. This is, you know, me in the spotlight. And you know, and it was really it was very eye-opening, you know, because it was a really I get accused a lot by reporters of being
an overnight
success, and I think that is the longest night ever.
The long dark night of the soul.
Right.
Yeah. So it didn't happen that way.
No, it was very much about building readership, and what I would like to believe is that the four people who bought Songs of the Humpback Whale,
who you love dearly still.
I do love them, and you know they told their friends, and the next time, you know, 8 people bought the book, and then 16. It's like that old
shampoo commercial.
Yeah, the Herbal Essence commercial, right? You tell 2 friends, and And that was really how, right? You all remember that. So that's really what it was like. I do think that my book spread through word of mouth because people were saying to their friends, "This is really good. You should try this author." But there were certain books in my career that I saw a real leap in readership. The Pact was one of them. Plain Truth was one of them. My Sister's Keeper was one of them. And you know, after that, it's been pretty steadily climbing. But there were all these people saying, "This is your breakout book," and I'm like, "Great," you know.
And
I'm waiting for it. Yeah,
I'm in the shoot.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a weird thing, but I know it was word of mouth, and I know it was my fans who were telling their friends and their relatives, because really, my publisher wasn't doing significant advertising for me until a certain point in my career. So it really was built just through people telling their friends.
Right. I want to talk about that book just a little bit, because I think it's very atypical for a first novel or for a young writer to write. I think most people's first novels, you know, those things that we're cutting our teeth on, are highly autobiographical. Right? We already know that you didn't have anything happening to you, so you couldn't write about that. But they're also almost always written in the first person. Mm-hmm. And they're written in the first person because this is your alter ego, And this is the character that you want your readers to identify so passionately with. Mm-hmm. And you pour everything, your spleen and all of your organs, into this character. That's not the book you wrote at all. You actually wrote this really kind of sophisticatedly structured, sort of multi-voiced, shifting point of view, hopping back and forth through time. What were you thinking?
I don't know. The funny thing is that, first of all, there are two funny things. I was closer in age to the daughter in that book, who was 15, than I was to the mother, who was 35, when I wrote it. And after I turned 35, I went back and reread it and thought, wow, I was psychic. You know, I totally got it. The other thing that was very interesting was that my mother's name is Jane. And that's the name of the mother in the book. And the only reason I used it was because I wanted the most boring name on the planet, and Jane seemed to work for me. But Jane in the book is in this emotionally abusive relationship with her husband, which is what causes her to run across the country. And for years, everyone who kept coming up to my mother kept saying, I'm so sorry. My poor dad is a lovely guy, you know. So everyone assumed it was autobiographical, but it really wasn't. And yet, there was this autobiographical core at the center of the book, which is so deftly hidden underneath all the layers and all the metaphors of whale songs, and that is this this connection between a mother and a daughter, this very strong connection between Jane and Rebecca in the book, which is what drives this cross-country story. And that's what was autobiographical. Mm. You know, my mom is one of my best friends. She's my first reader. And I talk to her 60 times a day, and you know, that's what I was really writing from.
Right. Yeah. It seems like something that you figured out for yourself, the trick you turned in that book, you know, this shifting point of view has really become your go-to narrative device. And I think it has so much to do with, like, when I read your work, it's like this, it's an uncanny marriage between structure and sensibility, because those people who write those super, you know, passionately engaged first-person speaker and are pining for that, for the reader to identify so wholeheartedly with that character, you write not for identification, but for provocation, to really get your readers thinking and to challenge them at every front, and the structure does that exactly. So somewhere along the line, you figured that out for yourself, right?
Yeah, I'm totally stealing what you just said there. That's so good. It really, honestly, it is. That's exactly what I do. A lot of people say to me, you write about such controversial things, but what I love about your books is that you don't tell me what to think. You don't tell me what's right. And that's very important to me as a writer and as a human. And the reason that I think I can do it is because when you read one of my books that is written in multiple first-person narratives, everyone gets a voice. Everyone believes very passionately what they believe. And it may not be what I believe or what you believe, but you're going to listen to it in a way that you might not listen to that person on the street if you met them.
Exactly.
And that allows you as a reader to ask yourself, well, why is my opinion what it is? Which is not something that we do often enough.
No, I don't think so. And what it's encouraging is that there are 10 zillion shades of gray out there, right? And this moral and
not to be confused with the porn novel that's out right now.
That's right.
Right? Do you know that? 50 Shades of Grey?
Yeah. 50 Shades of Grey.
Yeah, sorry. It's always really fun to share the New York Times list with that, you know?
Very funny. So, totally lost my train of thought
I'm
there.
I'm sorry.
Porn.
You know.
Porn. Oh my goodness. So 2007 is the year that is sort of the real launch. That's the year that 19 Minutes debuts at number one on the New York Times list. And when people say the list,
it's the New York Times list.
It's the New York Times list. And it's actually the only thing that really matters. So that must have been a real game changer for you. Did you begin to feel differently about yourself as a writer in relation to your fan base, or what happened at that moment?
I actually felt differently before that. I felt differently at the paperback version of My Sister's Keeper. Because now that book, which everyone thinks of as like my huge book, it did not reach number one on the New York Times list. It reached number seven. But the paperback reached number one. And that was huge. But it was, you know, again, it was that word of mouth thing, and it took about 6 months for everyone to hear about it and keep reading it. And so the groundswell of support from that book, I think, is what carried over and began to drive sales for the hardcovers. 19 Minutes is a really important book to me for a lot of reasons. Every now and then I get to write about a topic that is not just important to me or challenging to me, but that I think can really be a spark of light in the world. And 19 Minutes is one of those books. Right. You know, actually, when we were driving into town today, I saw that right now we're all missing a screening of Bully, the movie. Let's just go.
Field trip.
Right. I really wanted to see that. And I'm so excited that that's being done, you know, in a mainstream theater setting. It's really important that we talk about that in this country and that we stop sweeping school violence and bullying under the carpet and pretend it can't happen in our backyards, because that's exactly where it happens. Right. What I love about 19 Minutes, even more than the fact that it debuted where it did on the New York Times list, is the fact that by now it is taught as curriculum in over 100 school districts in this country. Mm. And that makes me really happy.
Amazing.
Welcome back to the National Writers Series and our conversation between authors Jodi Picou and Paula MacLean. In a recent Time magazine interview, Jodi Picou lamented the bias that she feels female authors face. She said, "If a woman writes about family and the connections between people, it's called women's fiction. But if a man does it, it's nominated for the National Book Award." "What? You can't have a heart and a penis?" she asked Time. Again, Paula MacLean and Jodi Picou.
You've been doing this. You've been in this business your entire adult life.
Oh, I know.
Your entire adult life. So that first book, you were pregnant, and now your kids are mostly kind of out of the nest. Your youngest is 16.
Yeah.
Now. And you've been known to say that success is really a double-edged sword, because mm-hmm. you want to ride that wave, right?
Yeah.
You want to sort of follow the momentum when the momentum is there, and mm-hmm. yet here's your life, mm-hmm. like right here, and are you really as engaged or as present mm-hmm. in that life too? And I think that's a particularly tricky bit for women,
mm-hmm. very hard.
Successful women who are writers. I mean, it's not very often that I go and I do an event that somebody doesn't stand up and say, "So, where are your children right now?
Right. How do you do it?" Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And of course, they would never ask that.
I asked her that 5 minutes ago, just so you know, but I did.
Which, I mean, I always sort of have this perverse kind of desire to say they're in a closet with some cat food, but they're fine.
Right.
They're fine. But of course, no one would ever ask a man that, a writer, you know?
That's why,
right?
I said that in Time magazine.
Right?
That's
now?
Exactly what I was talking about, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah, there is definitely a double-edged standard, a double standard when it comes to male and female writers. And I don't know why it exists. I don't understand it. I don't know why. Let's be real. If, you know, we were talking about Nicholas Sparks at dinner. If Nicholas Sparks were writing what he did and his name was Nicola Sparks, there would be someone in a bodice, ripped bodice on the cover. And, you know, but because he's a man, he gets to write what he wants. And oh, he gets like a big screen movie too. It's a very strange thing. And I don't understand that double standard at all.
Yeah. What did it feel like though when your kids were young and you were mm-hmm. trying to sort of juggle all of those, all of those plates, both in your career and in your family life?
I used to write literally in every 15-minute block that I could. And that meant if I was sitting waiting for nursery school to let out, if they were napping, if Barney was on television, if they weren't hitting each other on the head with blocks. Anytime I had 15 minutes, I would sit in a chair and I would write. And because of that, I didn't have any time. I didn't buy into writer's block because you only have writer's block when you have too much time on your hands. Really, think about all of the papers that you kept putting off and putting off in college. Isn't it miraculous how that block lifted the night before the paper was due? So, you know, that's really, if it's your job, you sit your butt in the chair and you just write. You can always edit a bad page. You can't edit a blank page. That's one of my mantras.
Right.
And, you know, so I really did subscribe to that, and I had an amazing husband. I mean, that's why you're so much more impressive than I am, because I don't know how I could have done it as a single mom. My husband was so supportive and used to come home from work and I would literally throw my children at him. And he would, and he would bathe them, he would put them to sleep, and I would go into an office and I would write until 10 o'clock at night when everything started to sound like Dr. Seuss, and then I would go to bed. And, you know, that I kind of had two careers at that point, and so did he. And if not for him, you know, I couldn't have done what I did. We really tried to balance the childcare that way. And then there was a point around, it was right around 2006 or so, where he began to stay home with the kids because we realized that either we were going to have to pay someone to watch our children while I went out on book tour,
right,
or he was going, we had to do something. And so instead, he wound up staying home with them, which is an amazing gift.
Yeah.
It was a gift to him because he got to watch our kids grow up. And it was a gift to me because I am probably one of the only women in this country who can leave the house for 3 months at a time and not even leave a note.
Yeah.
You know?
A good man. A good man.
Yeah, he's incredible. Yeah.
So you're in the middle of what can only be called an epic North American tour.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, sail to sail, on a plane every day, sometimes
yep.
two events a day. So, and you've been doing this for years and years and years, and I know that you must have some really good stories about being on the road, so
I
tell
do.
Us one.
Okay, so this is my best author hell story. So, it was when I had just started working with this publisher, which was about a decade ago, and, you know, when you start with a new publisher, you don't want to be a diva, you really just want to do everything and make them like you. And the thing about going on book tour is that they do try to make it comfortable for you, and they put you up at very nice hotels that are under about $300 a night, which can buy you a lovely place if you are not in Boston, Chicago, or LA, or New York. So my first tour stop was in Boston. And I live in New Hampshire, so a friend was driving me down from New Hampshire to Boston and was gonna stay the night with me and then go home the next day. And I had an event outside of Boston, so we drove there first. And I had been told that my publisher was putting me up at a boutique hotel called the Hotel Buckminster. And they said, it's $250 a night, it's in Kenmore Square, I'm sure it's lovely. And I'd never heard of it, but okay, whatever. So I get back from the event, it's about 11 o'clock at night, and the garage is locked. There's no way into the garage. So we have to park on the street in Kenmore Square, which is never a good thing. And I go inside, and I get my room key, and my friend Dee and I go into the elevator, and we ride up to the fifth floor. Doors open up, and a rat the size of my Springer Spaniel runs across the hall. So we're like staring at each other like this, right? And the doors close. We go back downstairs, doors open, and the manager goes, is there a problem? And I said, yeah, there's a rat on the fifth floor. And he goes, oh, it's back? So I turned to Dee and I said, okay, look, so I this is my first hotel with them. I gotta at least, you know, check out the room. So we go back upstairs and we open the door of the room. The rat is gone now. And I swear I'm not making this up. The room is painted, it's only half painted, and it's avocado green. There's a green shag carpet on the floor. There are two twin beds. There is no bathroom, but there is a toilet between the beds, like where a night table would be. I go, I can't do this, I can't do this. So we go back downstairs and I ask them to reverse the charges and they put them back and now we're driving the wrong way down one-way streets in Boston and finally we pull into a Westin in Copley and my friend Dee works at a hotel so she goes, you know, I work at a hotel in Hanover, do you have an industry rate? And they said, yes, we'll give you a room for $99. So we go to check in. And we're upstairs, and this desk clerk is typing all of our information into the system because she's trying to get us a room. And she goes, you look like you've had a really hard night. And I said, yeah, we have. We started at the Hotel Buckminster. And without missing a beat, as she's typing, she goes, oh, yeah? Is the rat back?
clubs. And you think it's so glamorous on the road.
Yeah. I'm happy to say I have not seen a rat in Traverse City. So.
Oh, my goodness. Well, you... How do I follow that?
Exactly.
So I know that you have sort of established such a rhythm in your career and your creative life now that you're always about three books ahead of yourself. So that you are touring for this book mm-hmm. and editing a book, mm-hmm. right, and researching and writing another book.
Correct.
And that all of this is it's amazing, by the way. I'm not worthy. Coming down the pipe at you. So. One of the books in the pipeline right now mm-hmm. is actually a book that you've co-written with your teenage daughter, Samantha. Say a little bit about that.
Yeah. So 2 years ago on book tour, I was in LA, and my daughter, Sammy, called me up and she said, "Mom, I think I have a really good idea for a book." And I said, "All right, let's hear it." And she said to me, "What if every time you close the pages of a book, all the characters got to walk around inside the book and live their lives as characters other than who they really are? Kind of like actors who get off a stage and get to go mm-hmm. home. But every time that book got opened again, they would have to snap right back into act one, scene one, and perform all over again. And what if there was a prince in a fairy tale who really didn't want to live in this fairy tale anymore, but couldn't figure out a way to get a reader to see him as anything but the prince in a fairy tale? And what if there was a 15-year-old girl who was kind of a loner and liked to read books and was obsessed with this kid's fairy tale because the prince in it was kind of hot? And one day she realized he was actually talking to her and he wanted her help to try to get out of this book. And I thought, oh my gosh, for anyone who's ever had a crush on Mr. Darcy, this is the perfect book.
It's perfect.
So
fun.
She said to me, "Can we write it together?" And I said, "We can write it. I am not writing it for you." So what ensued was 2 years of us literally sitting side by side at my computer on school vacation, summer break, weekends, after school, when she had time. And we wrote every sentence of that book together. And it was remarkable in multiple ways. I mean, if you think it's hard to get your kid to clean up her room, try to get her to write a novel with you. But there were also moments when we would be falling over each other to try to finish the sentence first, because we both knew exactly what should be next. Mm. It was like we were asleep and living the same dream. It was a phenomenal
Amazing.
Experience. So anyway, it's my first young adult novel, co-authored with my daughter. It comes out on June 26th, and we will be on tour for it for a brief time in America. And I'm so excited about it, actually. And Sammy and I talked a lot about making it something that could remind us why we fell in love with books. Hmm. Because way before there were e-books and anyone talked about enhanced e-books, we used to savor them, and we used to pass them down to our kids and our grandchildren. And at the turn of the century, in these fairy tales, there were these beautiful works of art that were illustrations in the books. And when you get the finished copy of Between the Lines, that's what you'll see, four color illustrations, lots of interesting little silhouettes cut out throughout the pages. It is a stunning book visually to remind us why we used to love them so much. So I'm really, really excited about it. And, you know, I've heard from parents for many, many years, I'd love to share your books with my younger kids, but I can't because they're not emotionally ready to read what you write.
Sophisticated.
And this is a really nice bridge because there's nothing objectionable in it. It's a really sweet love story. And I'm thrilled. I'm so excited to be able to put that out there, and hopefully you all get a chance to see it.
Yay. Yeah. Yay. So let's talk about this new book, which I'm a huge fan of, by the way, and I imagine that there are zillions of people who are gonna eat this book up too. And I think that one of the things I love about this book is this character, Luke Warren, who I think might be your sort of most, I don't know, complicated, quirky male protagonist.
Yeah.
And he's got this great relationship to wolves. For those of you who haven't read the book, he's devoted his entire life to the studying of wolves, and he's a devotee, and he's spent his time living among the wolves. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, we all love those nature shows, right? Mm-hmm. Like secretly, 2 o'clock in the morning, we can't sleep, we're watching
right.
those nature shows, like even back in the day when it was just the crocodile hunter guy, right?
Yeah.
Being crazy,
yeah.
Or there's the Bear Grylls yeah. guy who mm-hmm. like tries to eat a reptile whenever he can,
yes.
or like chew the head off a bug
right.
just to see if he can, right?
Right.
Or or the survivor man guy. And it must be something in us, right,
yeah,
that is fascinated by the natural world and believes that it holds some secret. And if we can just get close enough to it, it will sort of open up, mm-hmm, open us up and reveal our best selves,
right,
to ourselves. And, mm-hmm, and I think this is one of the things that's happening in this book. So talk a little bit about this character, Luke Warren, how you made your way, mm-hmm, toward him and all of that.
Well, the interesting thing about Luke is he is a male protagonist and he's in a coma from page one. That's a hard thing to pull off. And the reason you get to know him is by reading snippets of this book that he has published about his life. And, you know, when I started to think about this character, I wanted someone who had done something that I thought was completely unique. Go live with a wild wolf pack, because wolves are all about family and the family structure. And I thought, what an interesting thing if a person was so involved with a wolf family that he was sacrificing his human one. And that really became the impetus for making him who he was. So here I was thinking I'd created this totally unique individual. And then I find out, of course, there's a real life guy who's done this. And I have to find him. So his name is Sean Ellis, and he lives in Devon in the United Kingdom. He went into the Rockies, and he lived with a wild pack of wolves for a year after studying them from afar with the Nez Perce Indians. And he is this fascinating, bizarre guy who now lives with six captive packs of wolves on a wildlife preserve. And basically now he functions as sort of like a wolf CSI. If there are people who are rubbing up against wolves in their lives, he finds a non-violent way to fix it. But everything that Luke does in here came from interviewing Sean, meeting him, seeing him with his wolves, seeing how he thinks about wolves. And you know, one of the first things that he taught me, of course, was that wolves aren't these violent killers that you see in fairy tales or in the media. They're actually really intelligent animals. And for them, nothing matters more than family, which is why this metaphor was so important for me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. One super memorable thing that you remember from your interaction with Sean, or some really great story that he told, or something that still sticks with you?
Okay, so he was trying to explain to me how he sort of accumulated his knowledge when he was with the pack. Now, he says that they eventually accepted him as a numbers wolf in a pack. And that means he was one of the wolves that was there to round out the pack, to make it look bigger than it really is, and basically to just guard territory more than anything else. They knew he was human. I mean, they're not stupid, but he felt that they needed to know about humans as much as we need to know about wolves. So because he wasn't as swift or as fast or as strong as they were, he was rarely asked to go on a hunt. And what they would do instead was...
He was rarely invited?
Yeah, no, he would
pass him a note?
That is, no, do you want to know how they do it? This is how an alpha tells her pack where to go and what to do. You know how dogs sniff each other's butts when they meet? That is because there's a scent gland near the tail that is as individual to a wolf as a fingerprint is to a human. And literally, by moving the tail, the alpha can direct scent and tell the other wolves where to go. See? So you are invited.
But can a human pick up that?
Eventually you can, yeah.
You can.
I mean, he did. Like he said, when he first came back, and I'm getting off track now, when he first came back, he was crippled by the grocery store because there were so many smells.
Right.
And in the wild, there are only like six smells. It's not that hard, you know, so
amazing.
It's very different.
Amazing.
Anyway, so he was not often invited, but what they would do is bring him back like a haunch of a deer that had been rolled in dirt and feces and urinated on, and he would eat this raw, and that was how he subsisted for a year. He is an interesting dude. And anyway, there was one time, though, that the alpha did invite him to come on a hunt, and that was because it was an ambush hunt. And that's all about strength of numbers, surprising the prey, instead of swiftness and speed. So he was directed with all the other wolves into a copse of trees and sort of in a bowl of snow that they made for themselves. And they were downwind so that no one could scent them, the prey couldn't scent them. And he's sitting there waiting for the alpha's call to jump out and surprise the prey. And they're all waiting, and all of a sudden the alpha leans up, and she, I guess you reach up, you don't lean up, and she plucks an icicle off a low-hanging branch, and she starts sucking on this icicle. And then she directs all the other wolves to do the same thing. And they're all reaching up and grabbing an icicle and sucking on it like a lollipop. And Sean's looking at this going, what the hell? Why are they doing this? I'm not thirsty, so they can't be thirsty. I'm not hot or cold, because they, you know, so they shouldn't be hot or cold. He couldn't figure it out until he realized that by sucking on the ice, all of a sudden their breath disappeared in the cold air, and that was the only thing giving away their position.
Interesting. So you can't make that stuff up.
No, you can't.
It's amazing. Yeah.
Okay, so wait, here's another great fact. This is my favorite thing. An alpha, female or male, because an alpha can be a female or male, can sense a change in the heartbeat from 6 to 7 feet away. And this is the way an alpha would carry out a hunt. She would direct two hunters to stand behind a deer that she'd picked, and she'd wait and listen to see if the heartbeat goes up. Mm. If it doesn't go up enough, she takes another wolf and puts it in the front. If it doesn't go up enough, she adds another wolf, and she's waiting for that heart rate to raise to a certain point. Because if the animal is killed with all that adrenaline in its system, then when the pack feeds off it together, they internalize the adrenaline, and then when they go to urinate around their territory to mark it, every other pack who sniffs it goes, wow, that is a really strong pack, we are not messing with them. So she's thinking that far ahead. An alpha can terminate her own pregnancy if she feels it's not a good time for the pack to be reproducing, and she can also terminate the pregnancies of any other female in the pack because only the alpha pair is supposed to reproduce. So she's pretty much Rick Santorum's nightmare.
All right, I know you're dying to get at her, so we'll open it up to your questions.
My question really is, other than telling you how amazing you are,
thanks.
How do you come up with the different subjects that you come up with? I thought it was so amazing when you wrote the book about the child that had the brittle bone disease, mm-hmm. and then all of a sudden there was something in the paper about that. I was like, how did she know that?
So the ideas, like I said, are the things that, for me, are keeping me up at night or that I worry about. That book in particular came because I actually had a Sunday morning off on book tour, and I started to read the New York Times. And there was an article in the New York Times Magazine about a woman who had sued her OBGYN for wrongful birth after her child was born with severe and profound disabilities. And I thought, wow, that is disgusting. And I was so viscerally disgusted by it that I stopped and said, wow, why did I think that so fast? And it made me wonder what would happen if a woman decided to do that because it was the only way to get money to take care of the child she really loved, which is why most people do that, sue for wrongful birth. But instead of having a child like this real life woman had, who, you know, had the mental capacity of a 6-month-old, what if you had a child who was physically compromised but mentally 100% there? And I started to think about conditions that would allow me to play with that. And osteogenesis imperfecta is one of those. So that was how I came about it.
The question I've been dying to ask you is, first let me start with, My Sister's Keeper was a breathtaking ending where my husband thought I was having a heart attack on the couch. And I'm like, no, this ending is amazing. But I just want to know why. Why was it changed for the movie?
I could have told you that was your question, yeah. So, who watched the movie last night? It was on TV, right? I was having this bizarre out-of-world experience in a hotel room because I turned it on and I was like, I'm going to throw up if I watch this, so I turned off the TV. Although I actually did watch the best part, the Taylor part, which was truly well done. But, so here's the deal. When you sell the rights for a movie, as you probably know too, Paula, the author has very, very little say over what happens to that particular film. And authors matter least, unless you're J.K. Rowling or perhaps Catherine Stockett. And because of that, what we do is try really hard to give up our baby for adoption. And we hope it's going to go to a great home and that our baby is going to wind up, you know, leading a successful life and going to college and meeting someone. And, you know, and sometimes that happens. And sometimes you find out that your baby became a crack whore. So, in my case, I had said one thing to New Line Cinema when they started the process, which was, please keep the ending, it's what sold the book. And in fact, that was how the producer got the book. A friend threw it at her and said, I can't tell you what happens, just read it so we can talk. And when they hired Nick Cassavetes to direct, they asked me to talk to him first. And Nick read the book, and he said, you are right. That is the only ending for this story. And if I'm not changing it, but if anyone wants to change it, I'm going to tell you why, and I'm going to tell you myself. And I spent a year working with Nick as he created a script that was very close to the book. And then one day, I got an email from a fan who worked at a casting agency. And she said, did you know they changed the ending? So I called Nick, and I said, what's going on? And he wouldn't talk to me. And I flew to LA and I went to the set, and he threw me off the set. And although I even went to Toby Emmerich at New Line and told him how much money he was going to lose and suggested that they do test screenings with an alternate ending, they all said, no, 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 we know what we're doing. Well, they lost money on the film. Big surprise. The target demographic were people like you. And interestingly, you know, I think it was a beautiful film. There are some really great performances, particularly by the young women playing Kate and Anna. There are moments of beauty in it. And he made a lovely film about dying with dignity. Unfortunately, that's not what my book was about. And you know, sometimes that's what happens. The funny thing is that as a result of that very painful experience, which felt like I was being eviscerated with a spoon, you know, I wound up now having more clout in Hollywood than I ever would have had before that, because I said, you're gonna lose money, and guess what? They lost money. So now they think I'm some kind of savant. And now, as the other books of mine are being optioned, people are falling over each other to say, we can give you creative control, or you can decide the ending, or you could be an executive producer. And so that's kind of the silver lining here. Right now, the book that is probably closest for me to making it to the big screen would be Sing You Home, which has been optioned by Ellen DeGeneres, which is great.
Amazing.
And at this point, they have a screenwriter and a director attached, as well as a star. And I'm not allowed to tell you who she is, but she has won an Oscar, and you saw her going down in a big sinking ship.
You're sassy.
I don't have a filter, you know?
You've obviously told us what the worst moment on your tour was with The Rat, but my question would be, what's the best moment? What do you like most about touring?
Well, there are so many best moments, you know, and those are two different questions. Probably the best moment of the tour is on that first Wednesday after your book is published, a week after the Wednesday of your book publication, when you sit there at 5:45 waiting for your editor to call to say, guess what, you're number one. That's a huge moment, and I can actually tell you where I have been every single time that I've had a call from my editor. And like usually if she leaves me a voice message, I save it on my phone for a year. So it is a really big deal. And but the reason I tour, and we were talking about this at dinner too, is, and I really do believe this, I'm not feeding you a line, I think it's really important. It's the other half of the equation for me. I know what my sales figures are, and I know where I land on a bestseller list, but that doesn't tell me who is really reading my books. And it's just as important for me to give a story to you as it is for you to be able to say to me something like, I was reading My Sister's Keeper on a flight, and I was crying so hard that the stewardess asked me if I needed medical attention, you know? Or the guy, the newlywed guy who comes through the line and said, yeah, you came with us on our honeymoon and my wife ignored me, you know? And I love that. So that is why I tour. I tour because it means a great deal to me that out of all the books in the world, you chose to pick up all of my books and to read them multiple times. And I like knowing who's out there reading my books. I think it's really important.
As someone who is a mother, a single mother, and has an independent business and lots of writing fantasies, I'm a blogger. Could you share some thoughts about that?
One of the things I'm always asked, we were talking about this too, is will you write my life story? I actually had 12 emails just this afternoon asking me that. And I always say, no, I will not. You need to write it. It's your story. Even if you don't think you're a writer, you can very easily sit down and don't even think about a book. Just write one conversation you had that was memorable to you, or one moment in your life, one memory. And think, instead of thinking of the whole quilt, think of the quilt square. Make one really pretty quilt square, and tomorrow make another quilt square, and do that until you have a whole bunch of them. You can always hire someone to sew them together, but those squares have to come from you, and they have to come from your heart. And sometimes being able to break them down into those little 15-minute bits makes it easier than thinking of a great global novel. So that would be my advice for that.
With 19 Minutes, which I think was probably one of the most difficult books that you've written that I've read, how much did you go back to Columbine to learn about that, to put it in that particular book?
It's where I started, because you can't write a book about a school shooting without thinking about Columbine. So I went to the sheriff's department, and they gave me, first they gave me plans of the school to show me what had happened during the shooting, and they gave me all their police reports, because the first thing they do in Littleton is tell you how they screwed up. They know they did that. And then they gave me, they told me about the grief counselors. They had assigned grief counselors, one to each family, and they told each grief counselor, tell your family that their child was the first to die and didn't suffer. Now, obviously, they did this because they wanted to make it easier for the families. Now imagine what happened when all the families talked. They also gave me tapes that had not been, at that time, released to the public or the media, which showed the two shooters going into the woods and target shooting at trees. And as they shot at trees, they would call out the names of their classmates. And I still remember watching that on my DVD when the kids were at school, because I didn't want them to see that. Then, though, I left Columbine. I did not go in and talk to the students at that time. Instead, I went to the site of a more recent school shooting, which was the Rocori School in St. Cloud, Minnesota. And I talked to this kid whose name was Kevin Braun. Kevin had, there was a kid named, I can't remember the name of the shooter, I'm spacing on it, but he was a 15-year-old boy, and he went in and he killed two kids that day. He killed a kid who was sort of a self-proclaimed hick, meaning he would drive around in his pickup truck and listen to country music, and another kid who was a big snowboarder. His name was Seth Bartels. And he believed Seth was bullying him, and that was supposed to be the impetus. Now, he did not die, McLaughlin, that was his name. He did not die at the shooting, and he has been incarcerated now for two life sentences. This kid I talked to, Kevin, was best friends with Seth and was in Aaron Rollins' gym class, the hick, when this happened. And what he told me was that he was changing next to Aaron when all of a sudden they heard something. Aaron went upstairs and he was still getting dressed. And like 5 seconds later, he heard something like books dropping. And then they heard a teacher say, get down, Aaron's been shot. So everyone, of course, all the kids ran upstairs to see what was going on. And the teachers found the teachers surrounding this kid. And the teachers took all the kids and put them into the girls' locker room and closed the door. They were there without adult supervision at 11 in the morning. The police came to get them at 5 p.m. That's how long they were there alone. When they got them, they brought them to the library to be interviewed as witnesses. And it was while he was waiting for his turn to be interviewed that Kevin got online and learned that his best friend had been the other victim that day. He said that in the aftermath, his parents were very solicitous. What can we do for you? How can we help you? And he kept thinking, where were you yesterday when the world wasn't watching? He said that in the aftermath, they have now a rule where they lock the doors after school starts, and they don't let you carry backpacks in the school anymore. And he said, both are stupid, because you can carry a gun in the back of your jeans, and what difference does it make if the doors are locked when the shooter is sitting next to you in French class? And if you walk through the halls at Rocori and you trail your hands along them, you can still feel the chinks where the bullets hit. And he said his biggest concern was that the year I interviewed him was the last year, it happened in 2003, and this was 2007. So it was the last year that there was a graduating class in the high school who had been there during the shooting. And he was worried because he thought, who will teach the new kids everything that we've learned?
Thank you so much. Thank you, Jody.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Your song.
Jody Pico and Paula McLean at the National Writer Series in Traverse City, Michigan. The National Writer Series is a year-round book festival featuring great conversations with America's best writers. We hope you'll tune in again. I'm Doug Stanton.